In the studio from the Karioi Project, I've got Amber and Crystal. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Oh, you need to...
Morning.
Come over there. There we go. That's Amber. And Crystal, we know because we talk to Crystal every month. And Amber, what's your role in the project?
So I'm the education coordinator.
Yep.
So I coordinate all of things education.
Okay. And I mean, you guys do... I mean, you do a lot of education stuff. I was just looking yesterday. There's a holiday program, for instance, coming up. Is that part of what you do? Is that... Did I get that right? You're looking at me blankly now, Crystal. I'm worried.
But I'm probably just sleepy.
Oh, you're just sleepy. Okay, you keep sleeping. Amber, tell us, was I right? Is there
a- You're right. There's a holiday program coming up. We've got 3 days running. And we've got some pretty exciting things, actually, that we're doing for that. We're heading up into the bush to do some survival skills. And we've also got a few other cool days where we're going to see the science-y exhibitions at the Waikato Museum, and we're heading out to the Otorohanga Kiwi House as well. So, yeah, okay. Running for 3 days. We've still got some spaces left as well.
Okay, is that in the first or second week?
2 days in the first week and 1 day in the second week.
Okay, and what's the science-y things at the museum in Hamilton? What's that?
The science-y things, so the Excite exhibition there, which is really interactive science.
Okay. Cool. All right. So I know you didn't intend to start off with that. That's just kind of...
No worries.
I suddenly remembered and I wanted to check. All right. So what you're just saying to me off the air before that you've got some quite big plans for work at the area school in terms of programs up there. What's that going to consist of?
Yeah. So we're running quite a few programs at Raglan Area School in term three, next term. We've got the year seven and eights that will be coming out with us and exploring lots of seabird things, so we'll be talking about the oi and the little blue penguin that are living locally here.
Yeah,
we've split all of their year group into groups, and we'll be going out over a few months. So yeah, that'll be interesting given the weather that we've got at the moment. But we're going to have a great adventure. Yeah.
You sort of pick your moment and you're all right.
Yeah, absolutely. But no matter what the weather, it's just, you know, we'll just have the right gear and head on out there and have a great time.
So do you have to do work to, like, fit that into the school curriculum? Or is it a bit easier with year seven and eight?
I think it's more just to get the students out and about a bit of teamwork and just getting them out to see their local environments.
Okay. And so you're the one taking that?
Yeah, so I'm taking that, and we've got other people in the team. I think you met Lenny last week?
Last month, yes.
Last month, yeah.
Yeah, we talked to Lenny, yep.
Yep, so it'll be myself, Lenny, and we've got Megan that's also just come on board. Lenny and Megan, they came through our Manaakea program. They were students with us quite a few years ago.
Yeah.
Sort of come in full circle and now they're working with us, which is really exciting.
So, and we've seen Lenny at, I think, Tiuku School he was at when we were talking a month ago. So he was doing something there. So you've got a program for that kind of age group as well.
Yeah, and that's something that we'll be doing this coming term as well. So we go into the schools and we take species workshops in. And Lenny and myself were in Tiuku School talking about the local tuna, the eel, longfin eel. And that was a lot of fun, really, really interactive. The kids loved it. We had lots of great feedback. And that's something that we're coming back and doing this year at Raglan Area School too. So we've got a different theme this year, but it's a top secret. So can't tell you. All the kids around Town keep asking me what we're going in to talk to them about.
Is that right? And you'd like, no.
I can't break the secret to you. Sorry, Aaron.
It's easy to get information from a politician. Oh, no, it's not very high-level politics here in a community, so people just usually open up to me and chat. But this is interesting. So the kids will just have to wait to hear. So you do, like, primary school age, year 7 and 8, and you do holiday programs, and you have been doing stuff for NCEA. Is that still happening?
Not this year, but we've taken a little bit of a different spin on things this year. We're doing a few more wellbeing type programs. So we've got a workshop that's sort of in the making, which will either be happening this term or in term four, which is taking students out and into the forest and natural areas and just focusing on connecting with nature.
Yeah.
And well-being, and we've also got a group that in the high school Yes, I'm not sure which age group they're in, but they're coming out with us and doing a bit of work experience, and that actually helps them to get marks for the NCEA levels.
Okay.
Yeah, we sign them off for things.
Okay,
yeah.
Right, okay.
Mm. So and then we've got Fraser as well coming, which is high school, isn't it?
That's true. Fraser's coming in a few weeks too, and that is part of the NCEA work that they're doing there. So
Fraser's
lots going on.
Another one like...
It's part of their ag course. They do pest control,
yeah,
agricultural pests, isn't it? And so they come out and spend a few days with us learning, you know, the practical side of it. So they do a lot of the paperwork and a little bit of stuff at school, but then they come out and have a real life experience for a few days with us.
Okay.
Yeah, but the high school level, like the NCEA level Manaaki Awa course that you were kind of alluding to that Lenny came through, we're not running that at the moment.
Okay, and that's one of my daughter was in that as well with Lenny.
It's a little bit more challenging with timetabling it in and us having then the staff available to deliver it.
It
becomes quite a bit of logistics, and so at the moment we're not doing that. But in saying that, despite the challenges that sometimes brought and having the staffing and the right people and then at the right time, you know, because sometimes a class would be 2 or 3 hours, but sometimes only be 1 hour. So it's quite a lot of logistics to provide one course.
I know that
in the school.
The area school is so small that doing their timetable is incredibly difficult. I know they have lots of double classes. So,
But despite that, we did a lot of years working at that level, and the reward we now have is having those students come back and work with us.
Yeah.
And so I guess we've kind of come, like Amber said, full circle, where sometimes you do the hard yards for quite a few years and you sometimes tearing your hair out and wondering why you're doing it all.
Yeah.
And then you get the beautiful moments where people come back in and they're 21, 22, or, well, Megan's only nearly 18, you know, so she's still young but so wise. And so they come back in and you're like, oh, wow, this is cool, like all the effort we put in and
I know who
they're doing awesome, awesome work.
I think I know who Megan is.
Yeah, Megan Abrams.
Yeah, I coached her at soccer.
Yeah.
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 Right, and she's been in here. She's very comfortable behind a microphone if you need to bring her in. She'll be
cool.
Yeah, yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah, she came in for the surf club and there was a class. I think it was the outdoor ed class she came in. And I had three or four students in here and she was the most talkative one who had answers for things.
Oh,
and,
good. Yeah. Oh, well, that's good to know.
Yeah. Just grunt some answers or anything like that.
Fraser
is another one who's come through. Is that this Fraser you're talking about who's coming in, who I don't know who this is?
No, sorry, this is Fraser High.
Oh, Fraser High School?
Yeah. So
not Fraser an individual person.
No, so sorry, Fraser High is coming. So they come out from Hamilton. So that was set up by kind of through, you know, connections with Raglan people or Raglan teachers that work at Fraser, like Bugsy. And so connecting with us in the project and then bringing students out. So
do the kids at Fraser know this teacher is Bugsy? Mr. or Ms. Bugsby?
Yeah, he's passed it on now. But, you know, it's like so cool. Like they get these Raglan locals and they work in different places and then they've connected students to us.
Yeah.
And we just get to do the fun stuff with them, like taking them out on trap lines and, yeah, doing the bush stuff. So that's easy, but we don't have to sit in classrooms with them.
And are the teachers coming with you? You have the teachers there as well to aid in crowd control and things like that?
Yeah, the teachers come along on the trap lines. I think they really enjoy having the day out in the bush as well, doing a bit of predator control.
Something different. Are all the kids happy to see the results of the trap line in operation, namely the dead animals, or there are still some who are like, oh, I don't really need to see that?
Some are really enthusiastic, as you can imagine, get really into it. And others do it because they have to, because it's part of their credits that they achieve. But all around, they just really enjoy being outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of the students that I talk to have never actually been on a bushwalk like that before without a boardwalk under their feet.
Right.
So it's really interesting just coming in from Hamilton.
That's, my father was principal of Myro Intermediate in the 90s, which is just down the road from Fraser. And he said, I think they brought some kids out here, out to Raglan, and one of the kids had never walked on sand at the beach before. Mm. So there are kids in Hamilton who really aren't getting, you know, far from home. So that was the 90s. It's probably even more so now, I imagine.
Yeah. And you much we assume that kids do, and then they don't. And even here in Raglan, we've had kids and we've gone down like to Bryant or Upper Wainui Reserve, and they've never been there.
Yeah.
And we're like, really? But it's just not everyone's cup of tea. But then it's awesome that the students get a chance to do that and really explore their own backyard.
Well, that's the point of, I guess, of what you're doing with the kids as well, part of the point. But you mentioned well-being. Like, how does that – was that something you decided to focus on, or you just saw that that was something that came out of it? And whose well-being are we talking about? Are we talking about the well-being of the bush or of the kids? Like, or both?
Mm. A bit of both. So obviously when people connect to nature, they if they love the experience that they have, they know that they can go back, or that they know that the feelings that they have when they're in those places. So we've really found through the programs that we've done that actually that sense of well-being has always come out of our little briefs that we have after the program. So we've just sort of talked to the staff, and we've talked to the hauora team, the well-being teams at the local schools, and they've said that it would be a really great addition to have some of their students come along and do a bit more of a well-being project with us. Obviously, with a spin that is environmental, but also, just connecting to nature.
Well, when you get out of the classroom, the world isn't divided into strict categories. Mm. Like, you can have well-being and environmental education happening at the same time. That's just kind of how the world works.
Yeah.
But what you're talking about reminds me of, you know, Robs, who does Kutataya? Like, that's like the sort of the basic premise of a lot of his work is just having the kids in the space, and he holds the space, and the well-being happens because it's that environment.
Mm.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And we probably have that similar philosophy, but then also very action focused is like, how do we then, like, you know, and that's our whole vision and mission actually around our education program, is like connecting, like Amber said, connecting to nature, inspiring the next generation to care for it. So on the premises that, like, if you connect to it and it nourishes you, you know, something you love, you'll care for. And so if we don't spend time in nature, then how do you feel inspired to care for it?
Yeah.
And you can explore that in so many different ways. And like you say, nature, being in nature creates, like, we see it so much in the kids, like, that they become calmer and start working together and teams more, and they become different. You know, you become a different person when you're in the forest, or even in the water, or whatever environment you're in and that you love. And then, you know, in this age, like, we have to look after what we have, and with all the issues, environmental issues that are out there. And so, yes, we want to be contemplative and experiential and connecting, but we also want to inspire the action part. And for us in New Zealand, that is, in the large part, predator control.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to hear the birds, we're going to have to do something about it. Sorry. You know, like, and it's just, you know, and grappling with the reality of that.
Yeah.
And I always remember, like, Lenny saying to me when he was a student, he just looked at me and he always asked good questions. And he's like, and we're talking about predator-free 2050. And he's like, do you think we can really do that? You know, we're all like trying to be enthusiastic and motivate them. And I just kind of looked at them and I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to say to this young person? And I was just like, well, we put a man on the moon. And he's just like, true. You know, and it was like, you know, like, we don't have all the answers, but hopefully we can inspire the next generation to come up and help with the solutions that we need to protect nature.
By 2050, it'll be them doing it anyway, not us.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
So I'm like quickly doing the math.
Oh, is that what you're doing?
Oh, could it still be me? No.
2050? Well, it's only 30 years away. You could still be doing the odd trap line.
I reckon I'll still be kicking around by then.
Actually, I could see that. Crystal's still doing like the easy trap line at the base of the mountain or something.
Just the easy ones.
Well, I don't know. Well, stay fit, Crystal. You never know. You can still be going up the mountain. Yeah. So, Amber, I don't. Maybe I've asked you this before, but how did you get involved with the project? And then, did you come in straight and doing education programs, or did all that kind of evolve for you, being involved with the Karioi project?
So I actually met Crystal as I was her daughter Kanika's kindergarten teacher, interestingly enough. But my background before that was that I used to run forest schools. And so I'd moved down to Raglan and Chris, I didn't actually know anything about the project, and Crystal knew that I was moving out of that job that I was in, and she just said, hey, why don't you just come along on a Friday afternoon? We're running this after school group. Yeah. Just come along and see what you think. And so through that, I met a whole bunch of really, really fun, interesting characters, including the kids, really enthusiastic. And I just thought, yeah, I want to be a part of this. This is fantastic. And that's how it all started, from 3 hours a week to having a part-time gig with these guys. So it's been really, really fun.
Are you getting enough work from them? Do we like try and convince Chris to give you a bit more work while we're here?
While we're on the air, while it's official.
Yeah, that's right. Make some promises she can't break.
We really appreciate having
you. There we go. Yeah. You said forest schools. What's a forest school exactly?
So the forest school that I was running was actually at Long Bay Regional Park, just north of Auckland a little bit.
Yeah.
And a forest school is where we didn't have a building. And we would just basically tell parents to meet us at a particular drop-off point. We would just sort of roam around in the forest, and it was very free play. Actually, a lot of homeschooling parents would come along with their kids. And very open-ended, but really geared up for learning sort of life skills like resilience, communication, teamwork. And all of those skills, interestingly enough, are really helped with what we're doing now in Kariwa education, because even though we're teaching with an environmental education spin, all of those kind of attributes just come out of people when they're in those environments.
Yeah. So, I mean, how did the forest school happen? Like, how did you end up doing that?
It was something I actively looked for. So I'd been working and managing childcare centres for 10 years, and I really noticed when those kids were outside that they were, like Crystal said before, they were just different people, far more calm, far more able to express their feelings, talk about what they wanted to do. And so you have a rainy day and you've got 50 kids inside. You can just imagine the chaos versus, hey, let's put some gumboots on and go for a bushwalk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, and there's a bit of academic work in that kind of area now, isn't there? Like, just about is it eco-psychology or something? I'm really grasping at straws here because I can't quite remember, but there has been some research into that, precisely that effect, I think.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research around it. Interestingly, I think it's still quite difficult to get the motions happening for those kinds of schools to work.
Yeah.
But there's lots of research around it. A lot of people are doing it in Scandinavia and all across Russia. And have been for many, many years.
I think I saw a video about some school in Scandinavia, and kids were up the trees a lot. That's all, because it's a long time since I saw it, but that's the visual that stuck in my head. So,
yeah. They're all about taking risks with the thought that often there's research now saying that when kids get behind the wheel of a car, that's the first great risk that they've ever taken in their life. If they haven't had the opportunity to climb trees or be outside,
that's a sobering
slide down cliffs and all of those types of things. But there's a lot of research that's actually come out saying that it is a sobering thought. It's a bit scary, isn't it?
Yeah, and you can't teach risk management to kids the way you teach it to someone, an adult in an academic setting. And they process it and apply it. It just doesn't work like that with kids. They've got to experience their own management of risk, which might be clambering over boulders at Manu Bay or something, you know, to start with. I remember watching my daughter do that, and it was a little bit hair-raising, but I tried to force myself just to back off and just let it happen.
Yeah. I think experiential learning is just really where it's at now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love what I've learned from Amber is seeing you know, as adults, I think our inclination can be to try and fill it in for kids, like taking them out and trying to keep them entertained kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's like watching kids, you know, taking them into a bush area or something and just letting them explore and letting them go through that process of having a bit of boredom or a bit of, oh, what are we going to do? And then they just suddenly just get it, and then Amber would just have a few nets or some hammocks, or, you know, and they'd start making tents or you know, going in the stream and finding bugs or whatever it is, you know, but it was just kind of like, if you, you know, having the patience within yourself as well. So I think even being out there with the kids and watching them do that is learning for us adults as well, is like that slowing down and really just enjoying the space that you're at and living in the moment. And kids obviously got that down, but we forget that we can do that too. And that's one of my big learnings, is like, as you watch the kids and allow that to happen, it, you know, it does something for yourself as well. So it's a really nice experience. And I think that's a big part of our programs, is not trying to just fill it up with busyness and action and activity the whole time, but also allowing them that time and space to just explore. And
because that's kind of how after school programs have been used, is because there's a belief out there that education has to be directed, and that once school's finished there needs to be more direction. There's kind of an unwritten assumption or unquestioned assumption, so a lot of after school programs are there for that purpose, and so that people running them know that they have to say, here's the education that's going to happen while your child is here, and we're going to do this and this and make them learn this. And you're talking about something completely different. Mm. You're actually talking about a break from that, I think.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, and we definitely also have then the activity that they complete, but there's often also just the downtime, and the exploring, and like you say, being on the rocks and doing rocky shore stuff. And some of them will want a guide to find stuff, and others just wander around or just play in one little pool. Or, you know, it's really interesting seeing the different things that kids will gravitate to and what they enjoy doing, and what, you know, what and just the things they find. Like, you know, like I've watched kids and then they like find like the octopus and the, you know, the little fish and shells and that we can just rush by and not even notice. And just that ability to notice things is really cool in kids. So I love that.
Yeah, I think often too, when we slow down and allow ourselves to feel a little bit bored, that's when the creativity and the aha moments happen. Mm. And I think it's really important to keep that alive in all of us. Often when I'm out with students or with younger kids, like Crystal says, it's a really good lesson just to slow down yourself and just start really noticing things around. And of course, kids teach us so many lessons anyway. That's just one of them, and allowing the vehicle for them to do that in those spaces when they're with us.
And getting a bit of practice at patience before their lives get enveloped in social media is probably quite handy as well. Because I was talking with my 18-year-old about this the other day. Like, her life experience in the last few years, at least, has been one where there's always a diversion, and she's not particularly. I don't think we have an addiction problem or anything like that. You know, I'm not coming at it from that kind of angle that parents come from. Just reflecting on the fact that and the same applies to me. There's always a distraction if I ever have a moment where I'm bored. As long as there's a device around, there's always a distraction. I never have to go to that place. So, but you're talking about there's a point to go into that place, I think.
Mm, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And so, Amber, did you have, obviously this is something that's become a focus for you. Did you have a childhood, I'm curious, where you got to do lots of free play and work things out for yourself, or did you have your childhood that was the opposite and that's what's driving it? I'm kind of curious. Or am I completely off the charts here? Neither is the case.
A little bit of both, actually. I was lucky in the fact that my not lucky that my parents broke up, but lucky that they broke up and I had two very completely experiences with each parent.
Okay.
So with Mum, we moved to Auckland and we had a really busy city life, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
But Dad was actually in Waitatuna for a lot of my life, and so my most cherished childhood memories are actually roaming around in the bush and playing in the streams, and we had a lot of free time.
Yeah.
Days and days of free time, actually. There's a story that Dad tells where he was busy working on the farm and my brother and I disappeared for the day, and normally he wasn't that worried about that, but it started getting dark and my brother had a friend with him who was dropping lolly wrappers in the bush. So it was a bit like a Hansel and Gretel story. He found us because he followed the lolly wrappers up in the bush. But it was that sort of childhood where we just had no sense of time. We were allowed to create and be free. Yeah, it was really fantastic.
I remember periods of my childhood like that too, where our property backed onto a stream and then there was a farm up behind it, and we seemed to have the run of the farm. I don't quite understand how that worked, because it doesn't feel like something that you could just run over the neighbour's farm anytime you like, but we seemed to do it, you know. And yeah, and there was a lot of, we just make dams in the stream and things like that. That was always fun. I remember that. And I remember being dive bombed by magpies. So we used to take Dad's old squash rackets up and hold them above our heads, so if they hit us, it hit the squash racket. Yeah, I guess. And I don't remember much about that, but the fact that those memories stick in my head suggest that they were kind of significant things for us at that age. So,
yeah, I think it's something about the freedom and just being able to make your own choices about what you do. And, yeah, it's so empowering not having an adult around when you're that age.
Yeah. Well, it exactly is empowering, because there's no one there taking the power, no one micromanaging you. And like you were saying before about that, that's a real focus point, what you said before about when someone learns to drive and behind the wheel, it's the first time they've had to do some kind of risk management in the kind of modern childhoods. And so you need them practicing minor risk management from as early an age as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. So just as small as.
And I think that applies to everything, other aspects of our life as well. It's just the teaching someone to drive really focuses your attention on that. But I think we benefit in other areas of our life as well from being able to run our own lives as much as possible as a child.
Yeah, and in Raglan, I think we're really lucky because a lot of kids are outside anyway.
Yeah.
But it still does surprise me sometimes when I talk to students about what they do for fun in their spare time, and it doesn't generally include any outside time. So
yeah,
there's still those people around that that really need the benefit of connecting to nature.
Yeah, yeah. Hey folks, we're talking to Crystal and Amber. That was Amber's voice you just heard from the Karioi Project, and we've been talking about the education programs. But we've got to check in. We always like to talk about the oi every month when you're in, what stage of their life cycle they're at. But from what you said before, they're not really doing much at the moment that we can see.
Yeah, well, they're growing their eggs in their bellies,
I guess. Yeah.
So,
that's important.
It's important. So, yeah, so that in April and May they came in and they breed and prepare their nesting sites, their burrows, and then the mum and dad oi go back out to sea and feed up and grow the egg, and they're just about to come back in. They go back to their burrows, and a lot of those burrows are their kind of natal burrowing grounds.
What do you mean natal?
Meaning like that's where these birds were born, so the adults come back to where they were born.
Yep.
And and so they're going to lay their egg, and then their parents share care, but they leave the chicken in the burrow after about 2 days. And then it's just this tiny little fluffy chick that just fits in the palm of your hand, and it stays in the burrow, and so it's hugely vulnerable.
How does it even keep warm?
Oh, I don't know. They just do that really fluffy.
Mm.
And I guess in the burrow, they're quite, you know, it's quite cozy in there.
I guess if the parents have been in there for a while, they might have warmed up the earth around it a bit.
Yeah, but it's kind of got lots of fluffy kind of, you know, bit of
fluff.
Fluff and kind of like detritus from the, you know, like from the trees and the pampas and everything else that's out there.
So it obviously works.
It's
the least of their problems. The problems arise from the predators. So
yeah.
Are you guys preparing? Do you have to do preparatory work now?
Yeah. So heaps and heaps of trapping and monitoring.
Yeah.
And then we check out all the burrow sites. So we have over 50. So we know which ones are active or not active. And then we also have 24/7 predator monitoring cameras, so not just predator monitoring cameras. So we can see when the parents come in, we can check that they're coming in regularly to feed the chick. And then we can also check to see like if a rat or a stoat or a possum or anything comes along, or a dog or a cat or a pig, anything.
Oh, even a pig.
Even a pig will dig out burrows, yeah.
I suppose they would, wouldn't they?
Yeah, so anything that comes by, and then what we call is kind of like our incursion response. So if we see something come by, we can go, oh, you know, they've got past our traps, or they interfering with what's going on, like what can we do to prevent it from, you know, turning into chaos and carnage.
Yeah, you're right. That's
if we're not too late.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah, that's a bit.
I read an article once by a foreign journalist who came to New Zealand, and they were talking about what environmental work means in New Zealand, and it's a lot of trapping and ending the lives of predators, predator control. It's quite a brutal business. Environmental work in this country.
It's funny because when I talk about conservation in other countries, sometimes I'm like, what do you guys do? Like, if you're not trapping predators, what are you actually doing for conservation? But there's habitat protection as well, and also maintaining the sites, so making sure that they're safe and that we don't build all over them, because a lot of our coastal areas built on, and so that would have been historically breeding grounds. And then also, of course, in New Zealand, a lot of it's replanting, bringing the native trees back along our coastlines and stream habitats. Protect, and that's why Karioi is so amazing, with having so much intact forest still close to the coastline, because it allows the birds to fly in.
There's always been a corridor down to the sea, hasn't there? From the mountains somewhere. I know a lot of it obviously is gone, but there is a little bit.
And it's really important that we protect that and don't cut it up and take too many trees out and that. But also, like, there's a lot of invasive species. So we were lucky that the oi actually is able to utilize really modified habitats. So they'll burrow under the pampas grass, or even they'll come back underneath people's sparples and decking.
They're very adaptive.
And end up in people's sheds because they just got that real strong homing kind of sense where they just turn up again.
So if I find, it's not going to happen at my place, but if I were to find an oi burrow in my shed, just let it be? Is that the advice?
Yeah, definitely. Like, it's good to keep an eye on it, obviously, to see where it's going. So this one particular example we had was that under someone's deck they'd stored a bunch of kayaks, and so the bird was nesting underneath the kayak. And we've got some amazing footage of the adults coming back and feeding the chick.
So there's no shifting the kayak until the end of the season.
That's right. And then the kayaks did get shifted, but the birds still came back and made another burrow in the same place.
Right.
And so, the other thing is that people tend to do with the seabirds is, like, they go, oh, let's give them, try and feed them. So they're not going to feed, because they're seabirds, they feed at sea.
Unless you've got some raw fish.
Yeah, they're probably unlikely even. And then the other thing is, like, don't take it down to the, depending a little bit on the bird, but with the grey-faced petrel, you don't need to take it all down to the wharf or the water, because what they actually like is a bit of height to take off again.
Yeah.
So having it on a secure and safe kind of cliff area, or your deck or something, if you're higher up, if your house is kind of overlooking the water, can actually be the best thing to do, is just to leave it and it can just take off again.
It's probably it knows what it wants to do.
Yeah.
And it probably wouldn't be at your place if it wasn't somewhere near a takeoff point, would it?
Yeah, probably. Sometimes they can get attracted by the light, and so they'll fly into windows on the coastline. And they do sometimes get hit by cars or end up on the road, and people find them and report them into us. So,
and then there's storms as well that sometimes put them off course. I think that happened over in the Coromandel when AD was working over there in summer on the glass bottom boats. There's my daughter. Someone over there found a grey-faced petrel in the wrong place.
So it does happen. So, just protecting their sites. And, if you do have, hear birds calling out after dusk, and, you hear scurrying around, like, you can always give us a call, because we're happy to find new areas where we find, to find the birds.
Right, so you know where are good places to put them.
We know where good places are to put them, but also we can support people if they do end up having seabirds on their property. We do probably know most of the places where they are, but they can also turn up in random places along the coastline. So
And if you've got a cat, it's probably not going to work out, is it?
We have got landowners that have cats, and they keep them inside at night, and the cats have never interfered with
the
birds.
So it's actually worked out.
I think if you've got a really well-fed, domesticated cat that's not a big hunter.
Yeah, it's
especially
hard to know,
like, your really special breeds, like, they might be, you know, more the lounging cat rather than the hunting
the
cat.
The fancy breeds.
The fancy breeds, yeah. And so we have actually seen it happen successfully, but it can also go the other way.
Can you train your dog to defend the bird, do you think? Get the protective instincts going there?
I'd say that it's possible, but I think the inclination is for them to go for the birds.
Yeah, they just sometimes they just want to play.
Yeah. And actually, it's not just the oi, because we also have little blue penguin. So we've had cameras out over the last couple of months, and there's little blues coming onto shore. And so they're waddling up and down the beach and across the rocks.
Yep.
And sometimes on a nightly basis. And so they are even more vulnerable, especially to dogs. If you're walking the dog, you know, at dusk and that.
When are the eggs going to start hatching? Not hatching, but when are the eggs going to be laid?
In July.
After that point, people should be careful with their dogs on the beach.
Yeah, really careful. Yeah. Especially the southern end of the beach, and between that southern end of the beach and Manu Bay.
So we're talking about the ocean beach, not on the inlets.
No, not on the inlets. No, they're all on the open coast. But it's exciting to see the little blues coming back in. So they'll be benefiting from all the protection we're giving the grey-faced.
Right.
And we're seeing more of them popping up on camera, and we're getting random breeding sites as well.
And presumably, all the other species as well benefit from the work that you guys are doing.
We always
talk about the oi because it's kind of like the poster child for the project, but
they're not the only one. We've got our bat survey data coming out soon, so we've got an ecologist working on that.
We talk about that next time when you're
talk about that next time, But yeah, like you say, everything we do also benefits forest birds. They're just not like the poster child of the project, but you know, there's kaka and falcon and ruru and all sorts of things out there, and we're definitely seeing more of them, and people are reporting seeing more birds in their backyards. So
yeah, great.
It's exciting.
So we're talking to the Karioi Project. Amber's still here as well. And Amber, before we sign off, do you want to just remind people of what programs are coming up for the kids that you've got?
Yeah, sure. So we've got the holiday program that's coming up in the next few weeks. We've still got a few spaces on that if you want to enroll your child. And in term three, we've got Fraser High School coming to visit us, and we're taking them out to do some predator control.
Yep.
And we've got a few programs running at Waitatuna School and at Raglan Area School, where we're doing species workshop. Where we go into the school and teach the kids about a certain local species.
Yep.
And we've got the year 7 and 8s that we're taking up from Raglan Area School, and we're taking them on an excursion for 2 days, and we're teaching them about the local seabirds, the oi and the little blue penguin.
Okay, awesome. And if people want to get hooked up with any of those, they could just find you guys, well, except the ones already in schools, but like the holiday program, just find you on social media?
Yeah, absolutely. Send us an email, send us a text.
Okay, that's so Karioi Project. People, you should remember that. Nice and easy.
Yep.
All right, thank you, Amber.
Thanks, Aaron.
And thank you, Crystal, for coming in.